I was getting a little nervous there because my computer wanted to update and restart and all that stuff. And I would be completely lost without this. All right, so you might remember from last fall that Carrie shared with us a meaty and thought-provoking message on Solomon's book, Ecclesiastes. How many remember that? See, you remember her sermons, but you don't remember mine. Right. This then prompted me to give some sermons from another book of Solomon's, Proverbs. Anyone remember any of those sermons? All right. You're just raising your hand just to be nice. All right. And actually, we might have a couple more of those coming up from Proverbs, possibly. And now we're kind of completing the collection with Solomon's Song of Songs, which we started last Sunday. And I have a catchy name. This is the first time I've ever done this, but just to show you that I am a hip pastor, I have a catchy name for this series, taken from the opening verse, Love More Delightful Than Wine. And I also have a graphic to go with it. The kaleidoscope of image, of course, represents the effect that one has when reading the Song of Solomon. It's colorful, it's beautiful, but it's also chaotic and confusing. And this series, of course, would not be complete without this, the official parental warning here. So I'm not going to take time this morning for review. Hopefully you remember last Sunday's sermon, and if you missed, hopefully you listened to it this past week. And hopefully you read through the Song of Solomon last night, as I had asked, so that the content, or at least the general sense of it, would be fresh in your mind for this morning. As you will remember, the reason I decided to tackle this book is because it is often ignored or overlooked or worse yet, wrongly interpreted. Christians have been embarrassed by the subject material, and so it is often pushed aside. And when there are efforts to teach or explain it, well, it seems that there's some need to tame it, make it safe, water it down, which then turns the Song of Solomon into something quite bland and quite frankly, even sickening. The prime example of this, something I complained about last week, is that traditionally, or there at least has been a long tradition in the church that has advanced an allegorical interpretation of the book, which changes it from being a love song between a man and a woman to a love song between God and his people, which actually guts it of its true meaning. And this is actually quite irritating. And so I've decided to tackle this book, not because I'm attracted to love poetry, because I'm not, or because I want to talk about romance and sex. I don't. These are uncomfortable subjects for me. But because I have this nagging itch to fight for the Song of Solomon, to see that it is treated justly. I'm kind of on a crusade here to help folks both understand it correctly and appreciate it. Now, my approach here in this series will be a little different than what I've done with other books in the Bible. Typically, I'll spend a week or two on background material, and then we'll take several weeks or several months to work through the text verse by verse. But for the Song of Solomon, most of the focus actually will be on the front end of it, you might think. These are the sorts of things you should know when you read this book. And so we'll be spending 3 or 4 weeks on that anyway, if not more, and maybe just 1 or 2 weeks on the text itself. I'm much more interested in us as a church having a good grasp on what the Song of Solomon is about, how to read it, its value to us, things to look out for, tips on how to decipher the poetry, known issues and challenges, troublesome passages, and that sort of thing. Now, reactions to last Sunday have been rather interesting. A number of folks went out of their way to offer positive feedback. One person in particular thanked me for my willingness to tackle something that, to use his words, other churches would not touch. Another said that my teenage kids are here, you know, sitting with me, but what better place to have to hear such matters talked about and in a positive way, you know, from the scriptures. Somewhat surprisingly, at least to me, is that even a number of women in the church were affirming, and women of all ages, some married, some not. One woman, however, said that I needed therapy, but well, maybe it wasn't related, but I thought that was the context, but maybe not. And I do need therapy, for sure. Court, it is court-ordered, actually. But but I also got an email this week from a gentleman admonishing me that I should have shown more discretion. And perhaps others might have felt the same. It's hard to say. And so let me offer just a couple comments about that. I do not plan to be explicit for the sake of being explicit, but this book is what it is, and I don't know how you can do the book justice if you have to tiptoe around the subject matter or water things down. And on this, I am reminded of something I read over 20 or 30 years ago. And when I come across quotes like this that strike me, I always try to save them. And this is one that I saved. The Bible is a dangerous, uncivilized, abrasive, raw, complicated, aggressive, scandalous, and offensive book. The Bible is the literature of God. The Song of Solomon is the literature of God. The language is candid, but it is not crude. It is not prudish, but it is not immodest either. But compared, you know, to primetime TV, the Song of Solomon is really pretty tame. That said, today will be more comfortable than last week, but I can't guarantee that for every week in this series. There are subjects in this book, verses, entire passages that embarrass people, so we just need to be warned. And if you like, we can always rearrange the nursery schedule to find a spot for you in there. In fact, I might want to take advantage of that myself. So let's dive into it. Regarding what you should know when you read the Song of Solomon, I have 7 points for today and more for next week, and each one of these will be framed as a question. The first question deals with something that is more related to the background information, but nonetheless, it still has a bearing on how we read the book, and it is this: what is Solomon's relationship to this love song? Verse 1 of chapter 1 is typically translated along the line of Solomon's Song of Songs, or the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. All right, so real quick, though it is common to refer to this book as the Song of Solomon, verse 1 actually refers to it as the Song of Songs. In the end, either title works, and from this point on, I'll be using both interchangeably, and sometimes I might refer to it simply as the song. But this verse, however, does seem to indicate that the composer is King Solomon. And that could be the case, for we know that he was a songwriter. In fact, the author of 1 Kings tells us that Solomon composed over 1,000 songs over the course of his life. And so one would think that at least one of those would have been preserved and made its way into the Bible. And if any had been preserved, we would expect it to be the best of the best, which would be this one, as the title here indicates, the Song of Songs. The NLT translates it, the most wonderful or more wonderful than any other. Now, along this line, it is typically believed that Solomon is not only the composer, but also the male lover in the story, one of the two main characters. And this is supported by two verses later on in the first chapter that refer to the young male as a king. And indeed, because of these reasons, this has become more or less the traditional view, that King Solomon is the composer and that it is a love song about himself and his young bride. But to this, we might say, not so fast. The word king here might be more of a description than an actual title, symbolic of the way the young woman views her lover. So we'd want to be a little careful how far we would push that. And verse 1 itself, in the original language, is quite ambiguous. And even the English translations carry that sense as well. Yes, the wording can mean that this song has been written by Solomon, or even that it is about Solomon. But the wording is of such that it could also mean that it is dedicated to Solomon, or is for Solomon, or is written in the style of Solomon, or belongs to Solomon, as in belongs to his collection with Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. And so verse 1 is really not all that helpful when it comes to this question. But the biggest challenge facing the traditional view is this: if Solomon did write it, or if it is about Solomon, if he is the groom in this song, then it is very hard, I would say make that impossible, to harmonize its storyline of a mutually exclusive and very devoted one man with one woman relationship which gives such richness to the romance of the two lovers and their sexual experience, with all that we know about Solomon, a man of 1,000 different women, 700 wives, and 300 concubines. Wow, it just doesn't match up. Not at all. It's just very hard to believe. If anyone in the Bible serves as the poster boy for cheap and meaningless sex, it would be King Solomon. His sexual appetite and indulgence is way out there, even by today's standards. Now, some have suggested in response to this that Solomon wrote this book later on in his life after he settled down and took marriage and women seriously. Perhaps, but in my mind, it's still a stretch. For one thing, we have no record of him ever doing that, and personally, I seriously doubt that Solomon would have been able to do such a thing, even if he wanted to. Maybe. This perversion of needing many people, many different people, to have sex with is nothing less than a sexual addiction, and a disturbing one at that. And such depraved appetites are not easy to conquer once they've been indulged to the degree that Solomon indulged them. And so for this and other reasons, I find it just really unlikely that Solomon is the composer and unlikely that he is the young man being referred to in the story. Most scholars today believe that it is more likely that the song was written for Solomon, probably by one of his court musicians, and that it served as his favorite of all the songs and was therefore added to his collection with Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. But when it comes down to it, we simply cannot speak with any degree of certainty about Solomon's relationship to this book. Now, I did not find anyone suggesting this, but I kind of wonder if the song wasn't maybe written as a corrective, you know, a clever way to admonish Solomon. Hey, you might want to consider this as a better approach to women and love than the one you've been using. How about trying the idea of one special woman? You know, one woman that you devote yourself to and are faithful to and share your love only with her. And here's what that might look like, thus the Song of Solomon. But this is just all speculations. All right, another question we'd like to cover in such introductions is the date. I'm behind there. All right, is the date, and this is not too hard to figure out. When was this love song written? It's not too hard to figure out whether it was written by Solomon or for Solomon. Either way, it would have been written while he was alive during his reign as king of Israel, which would place it sometime between 970 and 930 BC, roughly 3,000 years ago. So this love song is very, very old. That's the point here, which of course means that it will be unlike the songs or poetry of our modern era. Next question, what is going on in this book? Now, by this, I'm not at this point referring to the story or the meaning of the story, but to the activity. Who is speaking? Who's being spoken to? How many different parties are there? And who are they? And just a casual reading of the Song of Solomon will show that there are two main parties or characters. You've picked that up already. And since this is a song, as noted in verse 1, we should probably refer to them as two main singers. We have a young man and a young woman. They are married, most likely just married. The fact that they are anticipating the consummation of their relationship is a driving point in this book. Several times in the text, the woman is referred to as a bride. Once she is referred to as the Shulamite, which could mean that she came from a village of that name, or Shulamite could be a play on words. If it is a play on words, a number of suggestions have been offered. Some claim that this is the feminine version of the name Solomon. Others assert that it means, O perfect one. But it's just hard to say what is meant, and figuring that out really isn't crucial to our understanding of the book. Basically, what we have here are a bride and a groom singing to each other about their love, about how attractive the other person is, and about the anticipation of enjoying their consummation. The songs, which are filled with compliments for each other, are designed to arouse romantic desires. To say it candidly, the effect of the songs is that they put the other person in the mood. Sometimes their singing is directed not only to each other, but also to third-party observers. And one such party is a group of young women who serve as a female chorus, which the NIV translates as the Daughters of Jerusalem. And from the text, we conclude that they are friends of the bride and that they are young virgins. They have romantic and sexual desires, but they are exhorted to wait until the right time, the message being it will be worth the wait. And again, this is emphasized by the high value given to the intensity of this romance, that it is so special that it can only be enjoyed in its proper context. Sometimes these Daughters of Jerusalem direct their songs to the young man, sometimes to the young woman, and sometimes to third-party observers. And sometimes in this book, the Daughters of Jerusalem are being sung too. And then in the last chapter, there is a short passage that is attributed to the brothers of the young bride. And so there ends up being a total of four parties. The young man, the young woman, they're the main singers, then a female choir of young virgins, and a small male choir of the bride's brothers. And depending on the Bible you are using, you might find these designations noted as subheadings in the text. And this is a song, so these are all different singing parts, and they take turns, but they do not follow a consistent sequence. And occasionally, it is difficult to tell who is the one singing, as the Hebrew text does not actually delineate the parts, but usually, however, it's evident from the gender, the pronouns, and other details. I mean, like, for instance, when the lovers sing about the physical qualities of the other person, it's pretty easy to tell whether the language describes a man or a woman, and therefore who it is doing the singing. So some translations add these headings, others don't, and among those who do, if you were to compare them side by side, you'd find a few minor differences, but just minor ones. All right, moving on to the next question. What is the story? Did one ask themselves that when they were reading it? What is the story? Well, this is probably the most important question of all, and in one sense, it's also the hardest one to answer. But in another sense, it is easy to answer. Though there is somewhat of a storyline, the Song of Solomon is a song, a love song, love poetry, and not really a story. You will become quickly frustrated if you are expecting to find any kind of plot and a sequential series of events all leading up to some great happy ending. It's just not there. Now, as you read it, it is written in a way that does reflect a story of some sort. For instance, we have a couple sections that are somewhat similar, which speak of a separation and the effort to rejoin. And there is also the arrival of Solomon with all of his splendor and his majestic armies. And these and other factors give it a story feel. But in the end, we have to realize that the Song of Solomon is essentially a man singing about his desire for his lover, how attractive she is to him, how much he longs to be with her, and the joy of the consummation. And she sings about the same sorts of things regarding him. And so we can speak of it as having a storyline, but we can only do so very loosely. Even the most, even the best of the Bible commentators struggle with forming a convincing storyline. And there is certainly no general consensus out there on what that storyline is, even if there is one. So again, as you read it, I would just encourage you to don't become distracted by that. Read it as love poetry. All right, next question, number 5, which is closely related. Are the two main singers, are they actually married? All right, this has been something that's been circulating for a while, generally among liberal scholars and people who want to see the Song of Solomon as some sort of license for sexual freedom and that kind of thing. And they propose that there is a story, and it is about two lovers who want to sneak off and find a place where they can have sex with each other, undisturbed, without anyone stopping them, without anyone's permission. And that this is what gives the storyline so much spark, the whole thing about forbidden love, as they say. And they point out that the word marriage is nowhere to be found in this book, or for that matter, there's no reference to any wedding ceremony. And to this, it is pointed out that the young woman is referred to as, quote, a bride, no less than 6 times. And they respond with, well, that is simply an expression of endearment and doesn't necessarily mean that she is a wedding bride. All right, so what do you think? Well, I mean, that's exactly what the word means, bride. Bride is never used as a figure of speech for lover, at least outside of marriage, in that culture or in ours. Not only is there no example of that in the Bible or anywhere else, it's just not feasible. Even couples who are engaged, serious, and planning on marriage don't call each other bride and groom or husband and wife. And there are certain words that are limited, and they only mean what they mean. For instance, use an example we can all relate to. Andrea here is kind of like our official church nurse. We all go to her with our aches and pains and problems. And when something happens here in this facility and we need first aid, Andrea is the one with the first aid kit, and she's the one that bandages us up. But no one calls her a doctor, and she wouldn't let anyone call her that anyway. And we could, I mean, lots of examples of this could be given. A bride is a wife, not a girlfriend, not a fiance. But even apart from that argument, there are other things going on in the text that clearly indicate that this relationship is exclusive, that it's intimate, and that it is permanent, and that it is a marriage and not some sort of sexual hookup. Take, for instance, the words, I belong to my lover and his desire is for me, found multiple times in the book. If it means anything at all, it means that the two lovers belong to each other exclusively. And these words from chapter 8, set me as a seal upon your heart, like a seal upon your arm. Now, that certainly sounds like a pledge one would make to a lifelong marriage partner. And in the ancient world, the engraved stone or metal seal was used to mark ownership. And so the meaning here is obvious. The seal upon the heart and arm symbolize a permanent belonging to, that is, an unbreakable devotion. And the description of love that follows that particular verse there in chapter 8 all sounds like the kind of love that you would expect in that of a sacred covenant, committed and monogamous. On top of this, the exhortation to the daughters of Jerusalem, these young virgins, to show restraint and not awake their desires before the time is right makes no sense if the theme of the Song of Solomon is about premarital sex. All right, next question, number 6, moving right along. Why is some of the language so explicit? And to this, of course, we'd have to ask, well, what do you mean by explicit? Even in this room, we would have a variety of standards in what we think is appropriate language and what isn't. And this was kind of demonstrated by the variety of responses I got to last week's sermon. Regardless of how awkward or uncomfortable or embarrassing the content in the Song of Solomon may be, because it is God's word, it is not too explicit. Right? Right? All right, so let us remember that though some of the language is at places candid, it is not crude or raunchy or obscene. And I maintain that a song is adult material, but is presented in a way that is adolescent appropriate. Now, I spent quite a bit of time last Sunday punching the fact that sex is not dirty and not something that we should be ashamed of. And indeed, the Song of Solomon is the antithesis of the cheap and meaningless sex that dominates our culture, all cultures for that matter. Here in these passages, it is presented to us as something that is rich, precious, holy, something to desire, to long for, and something so valuable that it must be reserved for the right time and for the right person. Indeed, the Song of Solomon presents sexuality as a good thing protected by marriage and not as an evil thing made permissible by marriage. Follow that? The Song of Solomon presents sexuality as a good thing protected by marriage, not as an evil thing made permissible by marriage. We should not be ashamed of the human body. We should not be ashamed of romance and sexuality. We should not be ashamed of the Song of Solomon. We should not be ashamed of the language found in the Song of Solomon. And so the question, why are such delicate matters spoken of so forthrightly? Well, to simply To put it simply, the Bible would be incomplete if it only spoke of romance and sexuality in terms of prohibitions, of what not to do. Why would we not expect the Bible to speak positively about something he intended to enrich the marriage relationship, something that he meant for us to enjoy? Again, just to say it again, the Song of Solomon presents sexuality as a good thing that is protected by marriage. It's not an evil thing that's just made permissible by marriage. And while the marriage relationship is meant to be a partnership and friendship on the deepest level, that does not mean that the sexual and emotional aspects of love between a man and a woman are themselves unworthy of the Bible's attention. It should have something to say about this. The Bible should have something to say about it. And it does. And does so even beyond the Song of Solomon. All right, next question, the last one. I would have had time today for another 7 more of these. So, moving right along. As soon as the sermon's over, I'm running into my office and closing the door. All right. Finally for today, and this is a big one, very similar to the previous one. How does one decipher all the strange comparisons? How is telling her your belly is like a mound of wheat encircled by lilies possibly, how could that possibly be flattery? Flattering. Or that her nose is like the Tower of Lebanon looking toward Damascus. Or when she says to him, my lover is to me a sachet of myrrh resting between my breasts. What does that even mean? Anyone struggle with this stuff when you're reading it? I need to bring up that kaleidoscope thing again. I mean, this is colorful, it's beautiful, but what the heck is going on? So this is a big challenge, and I referred to a number of these examples last Sunday. Once we work through the text here, we can deal with some of the more tricky ones as they come up. But there is a general rule that will prove to be quite helpful as you read the Song of Solomon on your own. It's not going to answer everything, but it's going to prove to be very helpful. Sometimes the figures of speech are comparing actual features or qualities or characteristics. You know, when I look at this, it reminds me of that kind of thing. And consider this one from chapter 6. The NLT is very helpful here. It says, your teeth are as white as sheep that are freshly washed. Your smile is flawless, each tooth matched with its twin. So as a compliment, it seems a little weird to us, certainly. But the comparison is obvious. We have quite a bit of that thing going on in the Song of Solomon. But we also have, and this is where things can get a little sideways for us if we don't catch this, we also have figures of speech that look like comparisons, but they don't really exactly work that way. They are more symbolic. Instead of comparing features, they are comparing the effects that one feels. In chapter 7, your navel is like a rounded goblet that never lacks blended wine. Well, he is not describing what her navel looks like, but how he feels when he looks at it. In telling her that your neck is like the Tower of David, he is not saying that her neck is outlandishly long, but that it stirs in him feelings of admiration and wonder in the way that the Tower of David does. Aspects of the woman's beauty provoke profound emotional responses, as does the man's attractiveness provoke profound responses in her. Each lover compliments the other by comparing him or her to the best of the best. She says about him, your head is finest gold. His head is finest gold. His body is like bright ivory. His arms are like rounded bars of gold, and so on. Well, he doesn't look like gold and ivory, but he does stir within her the same kind of excitement that gold and ivory would, the same kind of awe. We do the same sort of thing all the time. If I were to tell Terry that she looks like $1 million, I'm not suggesting that she looks like a big stack of green and white paper. Y'all know what's going on. I'm just simply saying that the effect she has on me is the same. Wow! Or think of the commonly used expression, those words are like a breath of fresh air. We say that not to compare words to air, but to express how those words make us feel. So if you don't take anything away from today's sermon, at least take away this. This is very important. Again, some of the figures of speech serve to compare a quality or characteristic of one thing to another, But many of the figures of speech here in this book compare the effect something has of one thing to another. And unfortunately for us, it's not always clear. The classic example, your belly is like a mound of wheat encircled by lilies, has been interpreted in many different ways. The most popular is that she has wheat-colored skin, which doesn't really match something that's said earlier in the book. But anyway, another is that wheat is symbolic of the nourishment that she provides. Another says the mound of wheat emphasizes the abundance of blessing that one feels, similar to the way we would use the expression, you look like $1 million. Another, the wheat and lilies represent the freshness of life. Another claims that what is in mind here is not the belly, but the womb, and so this is a comment about her fertility. Another says that the mound of wheat implies a rounded belly, not flat, which in the ancient culture would have been preferred. Plump was desired over thin. I just can't imagine that being flattering, but anyway. And to counter that, another one claims that this is referring to a stack of wheat that is tied up, shaped like an hourglass, emphasizing the woman's thin waistline and her curves and shape. And other commentaries I looked at completely ignored the verse and offered no suggestion at all. Cowards, cowards, come on. Personally, I didn't find any of these suggestions satisfying, and so in the meaning of this, I'm just as clueless as ever. And so while a lot of figures of speech can be deciphered, and some quite easily, others are more difficult. So let me repeat one more time that little helpful rule of thumb. Some of the figures of speech serve to compare a quality or characteristic one thing to another. You look like this. And some of the figures of speech compare the effect something has of one thing to another. You make me feel like this. All right, so are you sure I can share this? You gave me permission last Sunday. So last Sunday night, I don't know if I want this recorded. So last Sunday night, Terry asked me, so do you think my belly looks like a mound of wheat? And I had to think very carefully about how I was going to answer that. Because in Sunday's sermon, I had said that the expression was viewed as a compliment, but didn't explain how. But admittedly, it doesn't sound very complimentary. And so I quickly concluded that this was a trick question. And that Terry was setting a trap on one I could not possibly win. So if I were to say, well, no, my dear, not at all, then according to my sermon, I would be withholding a compliment. And so I played along with her, not a bit intimidated by her schemes, and simply answered her question with more and more, which has the effect that she predicted it would have. Because if properly understood, means that I am multiplying and enhancing the compliment. But it's funny because she laughs. She says, well, the guys will give a nervous chuckle, but the ladies will not think it is funny at all. But for the record, I did get her permission last Sunday to do that. It's the first time I've ever gotten her permission for anything on stuff like this. But maybe since Ian is here, I can close with something Michael has said once. He says this all the time. Every time I meet him, he says this. He says, Terry is the only woman who'd have you, and that church in Fort Wayne is the only one that will have you as well. All right, next Sunday, well, here's your assignment. If you would, at least read the Song of Solomon once and do so in one sitting. I would encourage you to read it tonight so that some of the points we talked about this morning will be fresh in mind for that. But then read it Saturday night so that it is fresh in mind for Sunday morning, and we can dive into some more of these points on what you should know when you read the book. All right, so Tom, are you closing? All right, I'll have you come at this time then.
If you would stand with me. Responsible and helpful and fun look at at all of this, and it just makes me think God's word is just amazing in every part of it. So let's just be thankful for that always. We're going to continue now with a responsive reading of Psalm 119. I'll begin. Your hands made me and fashioned me. Give me understanding that I may learn your commandments. Those who fear me and be glad, because I wait for you. I know, O Lord, that your judgments are righteous, and that in faithfulness you have afflicted me. O may your loving kindness comfort me, according to your word to your servant. May your compassion come to me that I may live, for your law is my delight. May the arrogant be ashamed, for they subvert me with a lie, but I shall meditate on your precepts. May those who fear you turn to me, even those who know your testimonies. May my heart be blameless in your statutes, so that I will not be ashamed. Now from Ephesians 3, now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work within us, to him be glory in the church and in Christ Jesus throughout all generations, forever and ever. You're dismissed. Let's go and serve one another and love one another and make the Lord look great to the world.